Welcome to our 11th meeting of the current season. And my usual reminder, please silence your cell phones or put them on vibrate. Reminder, our last speaker of the season will be April 17th, Samuel Bodman, who is the Secretary of Energy under the Bush administration. Should be very interesting. And now I'd like to introduce the Reverend Dr. Edward Thompson of the First Presbyterian Church to deliver the invocation.
I bring you the greetings of the members and friends at First Presbyterian Church, and it's my pleasure to be with you today. I arrived in Naples just in late September, and before that, and so I'm still becoming acquainted with the city. Naples, indeed, is a lot different from my hometown in Northern Ireland with its deep harbour and Norman castle, and very different from my adopted home of Edinburgh and its imposing castle. But at least in Naples, you make castles along the sand every day. Let us offer prayer. Let us pray. Today we celebrate in our midst the skill and the talent of those who write and use words to tell a story. Words to declare truth and chase away a lie. Words to measure good or harm. Words that cause us to ponder what has been and imagine what might be. Might we use words wisely, and might we choose words carefully. Now to you, Holy God, who remain beyond what words can ever say, be all blessing and honor as we give thanks for food and friendship. Amen.
And now, as is our custom, Shelley Church will introduce our student guests.
Good afternoon. First of all, the young women that we have with us today are from Pace Center in Immokalee, and I'm going to ask them to step forward as I'm making a couple comments. I'd like to first acknowledge our sponsors today, Pat Barton and Midge Voss, who are sitting at the student table today. Please acknowledge them for sponsoring the girls. I'd also like to acknowledge Luana Campbell, who brought the girls from Immokalee. She's the academic advisor to the girls at Pace Center for Girls. I'd like to acknowledge Luana. Thank you. She's so young, I mistook her for one of the students. So it shows I'm aging, too. So let me tell you a little bit about Pace. It's just a very incredible program, and a lot of people do not know about the program. And first of all, 55% of funding for PACE, of operating dollars, comes from the Florida Department of Juvenile Justice. The rest comes from the Collier County School Board, and the balance from local foundations and private donations. The girls that are chosen for PACE are girls that are considered at risk. It might be truancy, it might be abuse in the home, there might be academic issues, and these are girls that need some extra support around them to make them successful in their lives now and, of course, in their future. So it's a very, very important program that PACE offers, and we're always delighted to have these particular girls there. This right now, PACE serves 53 girls. There are 10 on the waiting list. There's a staff of 18, so you can see the ratio. Operating costs are fairly high for the program, and, of course, they're impacted like everybody else that gets any sort of public funding right now. Before I introduce the girls and have them come up, I have one last opportunity to plug the scholarship form that's on your table, the yellow form. It is really crucial. The Education Committee is meeting after the luncheon today. They have been out interviewing the students in the community. I know that the goal is to try to give 2 scholarships to each school out there, and if enough donations are in, that's exactly what will happen, 2 scholarships for $1,000 each. So without any further ado, I'll let each of the girls come up. They're a little shy, so be gentle with them, okay? Thank you.
Good morning, or afternoon, excuse me. My name is Kimberly Villanueva. I am a senior at Mockley Pace Center for Girls. I am 18 years old. I am ready to enter college. Edison is what it's called in Fort Myers. I am ready to study in dental hygienist. I'm willing to clean your teeth, make sure they're nice and sparkly and clean. I've been through a lot, failing one time in 9th grade, caught myself up, so I'm riding class with the senior class, and ready to accomplish my goals as a dental hygienist, ready to enter the real world and see what it's like. I am very thankful for being here, and I'm glad that you brought me here and picked me here, so thank you very much.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sarah Polito. I am 18 years old, and I am a student at Pace Center for Girls. My career objective is to be a practical nurse, and I will be attending the technical school that just opened up in Immokalee, the iTech. And I am really thankful that I live with my sister. She's the one who put me in Pace, and I am very thankful to Pace because they helped me turn it around. Before, I was failing my classes, and now I'm graduating on time. And thank you for having me here today.
Hello, my name is Yesenia Mesa. I'm 16 years old. I am a senior. I would like to attend Heritage Institute. It's a vocational school in Fort Myers. And I would like to study to become an X-ray medical technician. It's a 15-month program. I've been through a lot, and in my family there's been a lot of abuse. And thanks for having me.
Hello, everyone. My name is Violet Abarca. My career objective is to be an art designer. I plan to attend Miami International University of Art and Design. I'm 17. I attend Pace Center for Girls. Thank you.
I'm short.
Hi, my name is Amy Manzano. I am 17 years old and ready to graduate in May 2009. I am choosing to go to Florida Gulf Coast University to major in business management. I've been in Pace for 4 years, and Pace has helped me a lot throughout my years of school. They've been there through my worst and my good. And I am thankful to be here today, and I am thankful for Pace to be in my life. Thank you.
Enjoy your lunch. We'll see you in about a half hour. I hope you enjoyed your lunch. I have a question for you. How many of you read at least one newspaper or newspaper website every day? Raise your hands. I just wanted our speaker today to know that she's in friendly throwback crowd territory. She doesn't have the opportunity very often to find such a high percentage of newspaper readers in a crowd, except when she's hobnobbing with her colleagues in the Washington Press Corps. She herself has been passionate about newspapers and her profession for as long as she can remember. She was editor of her high school yearbook in Wichita, then editor-in-chief of the Daily Northwestern at Northwestern before earning her master's degree at Columbia in 1974. She landed a reporting job at Newsday on Long Island right out of Columbia, and by 1979 she was assigned to Newsday's Washington Bureau and in 1981 to the White House beat in new President Ronald Reagan's first year. She's been there ever since, although she moved to USA Today in 1995. Before long, she was USA Today's Washington Bureau Chief. She has covered 8 presidential campaigns, if I counted correctly, 5 sitting presidents, and several more ex-presidents. She says each president has been smart in different ways. Can't wait to hear what that means. But also, quote, perplexing with something hidden and mysterious, unquote. We don't know yet about Obama, but she has said that of the president she has covered, Reagan had the most impact on the country, and the elder Bush was the most liked as a person by the press corps. During her 3 decades in Washington, our speaker has won virtually every journalism award a White House correspondent can receive and has been president of the White House Correspondents Association. All of that is a matter of public record. There are 2 things you may not know about our speaker. She is almost as passionate about music as about journalism. And 2, she is one of only 65 prominent Washington journalists in the prestigious Gridiron Club, who each spring, since the late 1800s, has held a white tie and tails dinner to roast both parties and the sitting president in song. The rule is that the gridiron may singe but never burn, and proceedings are off the record. I know that everyone in this room has something of a love-hate relationship with the media. I sense a little agreement with that. But you would have felt only affection and appreciation, and certainly not hate, had you seen the March 21 Gridiron Show with our speaker wearing a long blonde wig and singing the role of Ann Coulter. She was willing to risk humiliation to help the most powerful of our political leaders and the journalists who cover them take themselves less seriously and laugh at themselves. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my honor and pleasure to ask you to help welcome the USA Today's Washington Bureau Chief, radio and television news personality, and the Washington Press Corps' star oboe player, Susan Page.
Thank you. That was very nice. I was a little worried when he said he was going to tell you some things that aren't widely known. Entirely sure what he knew. I'm not Ann Coulter. I'm very glad to be here, and I'm honored to be introduced by Alan Horton, who has had such a marvelous, remarkable career in the industry that I follow in journalism. And so glad to have the students here also from what sounds like a very remarkable and worthwhile school. Now, I have to say, you all look like you're a pretty opinionated group. And I'm going to talk about Barack Obama's first 100 days, or maybe his first 73 days, that's how many he's had so far. But I want to leave time for questions, because I know you have comments or questions or things you'd like to say, so I hope that we'll have some of those. Alan assures me that's not a problem, getting questions from this group. I know that many of you have had remarkable careers in your own fields, but I have to tell you that I am the person with the best job in the world. I love being a reporter, and even when I began as a journalist, I could not have imagined the incredible stories that it's been my privilege to cover. The end of the Cold War, the impeachment of a president, a disputed presidential election, so thank you, Florida, for that opportunity. Now a global economic meltdown, which has been a terrible development, but also such a fascinating thing to cover and to cover how we get out of this situation. And the 2008 campaign was quite a ride. Of the eight campaigns I've covered, certainly I think only the 1980 campaign rivals it in terms of how interesting and how momentous, how consequential this election was. You know, we started out thinking that Hillary Clinton would be the first woman nominated for president by a major party. We were wrong about that. There was a point when we were pretty sure that John McCain had lost his opportunity to be the Republican nominee for president. We were wrong about that. We were skeptical that an African American with a funny name and just 4 years in the Senate could possibly be elected to the White House, but we were wrong about that. So as the saying goes, we are often wrong, but we are never in doubt. You might wonder, in fact, why you're bothering to listen to me today with that record, but here goes. You know, this has been the fifth president I've covered in the process of taking over the presidency, and we have never seen in that time since Ronald Reagan took over a president who has done so much and sought to do so much in his opening months in office. Now, Reagan and Bill Clinton both sought to get off to fast starts and both tried to do big things, and they did do some big things. But in terms of the amount of money that's been spent, in terms of the assertion of federal governmental powers in some unexpected places, and in the sharpness of the turnaround in the direction, political direction of the country in comparison with the previous president, that's really been, I think, unprecedented in my time in Washington. And we're covering this very interesting new president, different, I think, from most of the politicians I've covered. You know, most politicians really want you to like them. And Bill Clinton in particular, if you were interviewing him, or even if you were just in a small group, or even if you were just at a rally, he was not going to be satisfied until he had made you love him. It was important to him. It was one of the things that drove him. That's not true with Barack Obama. Barack Obama is a much cooler and more self-contained figure. I interviewed him during the campaign. I interviewed him a few days before the inauguration. And he's very smart and extremely gifted politician, maybe the most gifted politician I've ever covered. But it's okay with him if you don't like him. And that is not the force at the core of his being that drives him to be a politician. We covered him during this long campaign, 2 years from the time he announced he was running for president until he was elected president. And we thought we knew a lot about him, but there have been some surprises, both in the political landscape and in Barack Obama himself, things that we've learned. So let me talk about some of the surprises in the political landscape. When the 2008 campaign started, there was an issue that differentiated Barack Obama and that defined the Democratic contest, and that was the war in Iraq. And now, as he takes over as president, the war in Iraq is no longer a top-tier issue, which I would not have believed you if you had told me that 2 years ago. We have not only this economic crisis that's become the number one issue, but even if you just look at national security foreign policy issues, the situation in Pakistan and Afghanistan, the situation with Russia and China and Iran, they all have more urgency now than the war in Iraq. That's been a surprise. And I'll tell you a second surprise is during the inauguration, it was a very emotional inauguration, especially for the Washington, D.C. community itself, you know, a majority black community, to have an African-American president taking office. And that, at this point, I think has turned out not to matter very much. I don't think people think of Barack Obama now as an African-American president. They think of him as the president, whether you like what he's doing or don't like what he's doing. So his race has turned out to matter less, I think, than we would have predicted. He promised, one of his fundamental promises was to change the way things work in Washington, and that has not happened. You know, we had about 45 minutes of bipartisanship, and then that was over, and now what we have is mostly a fight about who's responsible for the fact that we don't have any bipartisanship anymore, not much. We see Republicans very much against and pretty united against Barack Obama's initiatives, and one of his big critics now is Judd Gregg, the senator from New Hampshire, who was originally going to be in his cabinet. He also talked about undercutting the power of lobbyists. Well, I can tell you a lot of industries are facing layoffs these days, but that does not include K Street. The lobbyists are doing very well, and especially with this big spending these big spending programs we see with the federal government, that's been a boon to the lobbyists. And I'll tell you one other thing that's been a little bit of a surprise, and that is the way Michelle Obama has become a big asset for Barack Obama. During the campaign, people didn't know very much about Michelle Obama, and the thing that got the most attention was when she was at doing a campaign event, and she said that this was the first time she, as an adult, that she was proud of her country. How many of you remember that comment? Well, that struck a lot of people the wrong way, and she said that she had been misunderstood and that that was not really what she had meant to say. But for a lot of people, that was the main thing they knew about Michelle Obama, and it was not clear that she was going to be an asset to Barack Obama during the campaign. In fact, she took a pretty low-profile role after that. But since taking over, since moving into the White House, she has been, I think, pretty pitch perfect with Americans, with her focus on her kids and planting the garden, talking about healthful eating, making the treatment of military families a priority for her. It would make you think that Barack Obama is not the only smart politician in that family. And we were out in the field, we do polling, USA Today Gallup poll. We were out in the field last weekend. We haven't released these numbers yet, so don't go post them on the internet or in your blog. But in this, in the poll we took last weekend, Michelle Obama has a 72% approval rating among Americans. Now, that is really high. You know, the Dalai Lama does not have a 72% approval rating. Barack Obama does not have a 72% approval rating, but Michelle Obama does, and she has become, I think, a very interesting figure when you look at the kind of dynamics of the White House. So what have we learned about Obama himself? Well, one thing is he's pretty pragmatic. He has been less ideological than some people thought he might be. He's been willing to anger some of the most liberal Democrats who were among his most avid supporters by delaying the withdrawal of troops from Iraq and backloading that, so it's going to start later than he had indicated it would during the campaign, by the significant increase of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. It's now pretty clear that we're going to have a big U.S. deployment in Afghanistan through his first term. That's been a dismaying thing for some of the anti-war activists who helped get his campaign started 2 years ago. And he's promised to close Guantanamo Bay and has changed some of the rules of interrogation, he's also maintained some of the extraordinary presidential powers in the fight against terrorism that were controversial during the Bush administration and that some of his supporters hoped he would get rid of. But while he's not particularly, I think he's less ideological, he's not unwilling to be bold. He's not unwilling to do dramatic things and even to risk overreaching. You should just ask Rick Wagner about that, wherever he's vacationing these days. Sometimes I think the Obama administration is not entirely sure what to do in addressing this economic crisis, but they think it's necessary to do something. And you can hear the president and the Treasury Secretary both talk about the risk of doing too little that's a bigger danger than the risk of doing too much. And I know this is not a heavily Democratic neighborhood, so some of you may well feel that he's doing too much. And the White House recognizes that, but they worry more about doing too little and not being able to get out of this economic crisis than doing too much and having to peel back as time goes on. And perhaps the most surprising thing of all is that Barack Obama and his White House can have a kind of tin ear when it comes to politics. You know, they had this flawless campaign, really, and a remarkable campaign, especially for someone who hadn't run for president before. Of all the campaigns I've covered, by far the most mistake-free operation was Barack Obama's presidential campaign. And that reflects him as well as his top strategist. But he's made some missteps in office that have to go with understanding what people expect from him. He was surprised when Americans who pay their taxes did not want to see people taking cabinet jobs who had not paid their taxes. So that became as controversial as it did. His administration was slow to recognize that the payment of those AIG bonuses was going to really resonate with people. When he signed that appropriations bill last week that had all those earmarks in it and argued that it was last year's bill, it's not his bill, I think the White House was surprised when people said, no, that's a violation of some of the commitments that some of the rhetoric that you had during the campaign. And he made that joke about the Special Olympics that was particularly unfortunate, and that he apologized for. I can tell you we were flooded with letters to the editor from people who were upset about that. Now, in almost all of those cases, the White House recognized the problem and often did some pretty quick footwork to address it. You know, the White House was not outraged about the AIG bonuses until they were, and then they were very outraged about it. So they've been quick learners and quick to pivot, but it's noteworthy, I think, that they didn't recognize some of these things as missteps from the start, and that's something we certainly want to watch. His biggest strength now is that Americans generally are pulling for him. So when we did this favorable and unfavorable poll last weekend, 69% of Americans have a favorable opinion of Barack Obama, which is of extremely favorable standing. For instance, George W. Bush, we asked about him as well in this poll, 35% have a favorable opinion of George W. Bush. So you can see how Barack Obama is in a very formidable position now with Americans. I think people feel we're in a great crisis as a country, and as in other times of crisis, people are continuing to kind of want to pull together and get us out of this. That won't last forever in a presidency, but that's true now. And you find his best group during the campaign and today are among young people, among what we call the millennial generation, people who were born between 1979 and 1995. So most of you would fall into that millennial generation. These are people who are 14 or 15 now, the youngest millennials. The oldest are 30. Of those who were old enough to vote in 2008, they voted for Barack Obama by 2-1. And of all the bad news that Republicans got in 2008, and Republicans got a fair amount of bad news in the election, that is the worst news for the Republican Party. Because there's a kind of stickiness to your first vote for president. So I want you to think yourself about the first person you voted for president, what party was he in? And I want you to think about the last person you voted for president, maybe last November, and what party was he in? How many people voted for the same party in their first election as in the most recent one? Wow. And how many people changed parties over that time? So by maybe 2-1, people have stuck with the party that brought them to politics, that they voted for as young people. You know, for FDR created a generation that was solidly Democratic as they aged through the population, and Reagan created a generation that tended to be conservative, many of the people in the Reagan generation. And if Obama's appeal with the millennial generation, the biggest generation in American history, bigger than the baby boom generation, although they're not all old enough yet to vote, this could be the most significant part of Obama's legacy. So I'm going to stop there and hope you have questions and comments, and thank you very much. You know, the fact is, I find when I speak, or when I know that the Diane Rehm show is aired on the local station, local NPR station here, which I'm really glad to hear, that the best part of the hour is often the callers, you know, because people have such great perspectives. And so I wanted to leave time for questions, and so I'm putting you on the spot.
You are, and I'm going to try to sort through these 75 questions, about 17 of which I've actually read. There were a fair number of questions that kind of reflected by this very simple question. When will the media love affair with Obama end?
You know, I think it is fair to be critical of the news media for the coverage of Barack Obama in 2008. I think it was not critical enough. I think there should have been more aggressive coverage of his record as a state legislator, for instance. I think that's a fair point to make. I think it's no longer quite so fair a point. Now that he's president, I think the kind of traditional news media adversarial relationship has kicked in more, and that the coverage is getting tougher. But I agree that the excitement about the first really serious African-American candidate for president was one that was meant a lot to a lot of Americans and to some of the journalists covering him, and that that should not have precluded the kind of tough coverage that is the reason that we became journalists and the reason that you all read newspapers, which I thank you for.
I can't resist this one. It's a kind of an inside question. What do you think of President Obama skipping the gridiron dinner?
I think it's the biggest mistake he's made so far. I mean, there was a misstep on that whole banking thing, but the gridiron dinner is sacred.
Yeah.
You know, we were disappointed that he didn't come. He was the first president since Grover Cleveland not to come to his first gridiron dinner as president. That's not to say he hadn't been at the gridiron dinner. In 2004, when he had been elected to the Senate but had not yet taken office, he came and spoke at the winter gridiron dinner, which is one with just members, and he was terrific. And in 2006, he came and spoke at the spring dinner, which is the big dinner where we do the very elaborate show, and he did great. So it was a surprise to us that he didn't come, and we hope he comes next year, and we assume he will. But it was a disappointment. On the other hand, if you ask America what they care about with the president and the White House and what things are going, the gridiron dinner probably for America ranks pretty low.
Really?
That'd be my impression.
I Phil Lewis, the editor of the Naples Daily News, is sitting at the speaker's table, so I have got to ask this question. Having read in the Naples Daily News that the entourage for Obama's trip to the UK numbered 500, 200 Secret Service, White House chef, White House kitchen staff, in order to other diplomats and aides and so on and so forth, it goes on to go on. What do you think about that? How is that perceived overseas when the president shows up with 500?
Well, I remember when Clinton was, I think it was Clinton was at the went to London, had a big entourage and I think like an 18-car motorcade, and the Queen drove up in her own car to meet him. So there was like a pretty big contrast there. You know, it's these entourages are huge. As Phil Jones knows, that was great to see Phil, who has done many. We have done many White House trips together.
Let me interrupt and say, some of you don't know, but one of the president's duties is to make sure sitting here at every meeting is a backup speaker, in case something happens to the speaker. And we've called on Phil a couple of times, and he's getting worried that the odds are starting to be against him. He's going to have to speak. He's ready.
You know, he looked a little disappointed when he saw me at the reception beforehand. Maybe that was why. These are huge entourages for any president. And I certainly don't begrudge the security, because we all want, whatever we think of the president's politics, we don't want there to be an incident. And there's a huge, the huge press entourage. You know, the press entourage got smaller toward the end of President Bush's second term, and it became kind of an issue because you need a big enough press corps to sustain the charter that follows the president and so on. But there was no problem with getting a big press corps for Obama's first overseas trip. There's a big press group, lots of public curiosity about how he's doing. I don't know if you saw the town hall meeting he did this morning in Strasbourg, France, where he gave a very interesting speech that said America bore some of the responsibility for the economic meltdown, although he said others did as well. He said America had been arrogant in its attitude toward Europe. That got a very positive reception with that particular audience. But he also said that Europe had become reflexively anti-American in ways that were inappropriate. I thought it was a surprisingly substantive speech for that kind of forum, and a very interesting one. So there's lots of curiosity. I guess I'm not outraged by the big entourage that ends up with a U.S. president. Although I do remember with the Queen driving up, and she must have been thinking, "Who are all these cars?"
There are a large number of questions that essentially center around this one: did you vote for Obama?
You know, I've been registered as an independent my whole life. I've never registered with a political party. I've never engaged in partisan activities or activities that involve causes in which I cover. And I've never told anyone who I voted for, which I will continue today. I don't tell my children who I vote for because they're blabbermouths and who knows who they would tell. You know, I try. So there are some reporters who don't vote, and I certainly respect reporters who don't vote. I love voting. You know, I love the act of going to vote. I don't like absentee voting. I like going in and like pulling a lever. And so I do vote, but I try very hard not to see things through partisan eyes when I cover them. And that's why I decline respectfully to answer your question.
I'm proud of you.
Yeah.
That's a great answer. If Obama is so brilliant, why do you think he needs teleprompters?
You know, this is, it's so interesting. This has become a big issue. And he was using a teleprompter today, by the way, at the town hall meeting. I think he uses teleprompters because he is a wordsmith, and he's a wonderful writer. We know this because he wrote a book before he was famous, so we know he actually wrote it. And it's a beautiful book, actually. And I think that he wants to read words that reflect the care he's taken in choosing them. Because the fact is, he's not bad in extemporaneous exchanges. You know, he took questions from this town hall today. Now, the questions were all extremely friendly. It's not like he got critical questions. But it's not that he can't handle himself, or then that endless string of debates we had during the Democratic primaries. You know, he was perfectly able of handling himself. But he does use a teleprompter in almost every circumstance where he can, including, and this is unusual, using a teleprompter when he came and made the opening statement at his press conference, just his second press conference 2 weeks ago, second, you know, full-fledged, nationally televised evening news conference. So it's becoming a little bit of an issue. Now, how many people think this is an issue and he shouldn't be using a teleprompter? And how many people think, who cares whether he uses a teleprompter? Yeah. I think I'm surprised that it's gotten the resonance it has, but we hear from readers that they think this is an issue.
Some of us wish President Bush had used one more often. sorry about that. And he graduated from my alma mater, too. Will Nancy Pelosi survive as Speaker of the House under Obama?
I would say yes. I mean, I think Nancy Pelosi has pretty good control of that caucus. And it's not up to Barack Obama whether Nancy Pelosi continues to be speaker or not. Nancy Pelosi in some ways has not been the most popular spokesman for the Democratic point of view, but she has control of the Democratic caucus, and she's got a pretty good majority there. And Barack Obama's problems are going to be in the Senate, not in the House. So you might ask, is Harry Reid going to survive as majority leader of the Senate? Because like Nancy Pelosi, he's gotten some negative reviews for the way he's handled that. But Harry Reid is very popular with Democratic senators, and that is his constituency.
We talked a little bit about the gridiron, and obviously we know that...
And you want me to sing? Cause
oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But
or play
but
my oboe.
That's the closing
yeah.
act.
Yeah.
We'll right. get there. Everybody wants to know, where's Joe Biden? In fact, here's a question. It's
where's
that simple.
Joe
where's Joe Biden? I know he was at the gridiron dinner.
He was.
And made the speech in place of the president and made some very funny remarks about the president's absence.
He said that the president couldn't be there because he was preparing for Easter. And then in a stage whisper, he said he thinks it's about him. Which I thought was about the most dangerous joke I've ever heard a vice president tell.
Well, in all seriousness, yeah. What is Joe Biden doing besides occasionally saying things like that?
You know, I think Joe Biden is trying to adjust to this very different role. You know, he's been a senator approximately forever. And when you're a senator, you're your own boss. Nobody's really the boss of you. And he is, as we all know, a pretty loquacious guy. And I think he's having to adjust to the fact that he is the vice president. There were a couple of incidents where Obama made it clear that he didn't want Biden creating problems for him. You may remember when Biden made a joke about Justice Roberts messing up the oath, the swearing-in at the inauguration, that you just had to look at Obama's expression when Biden said that, to know that this was something that Obama did not appreciate, and I assume they talked about it afterwards. One can only wish you were on in that meeting. But I also think that, you know, when you talk to President Obama, talks about what he was looking for in a vice president. And there's a kind of a classic line, you can choose somebody, a vice president that gives you, who's good for you when they're announced, when their name is announced. And Sarah Palin would be in that category. Because when Sarah Palin was announced, there was, first of all, there was a little bit of, who's Sarah Palin? But then when the initial reception that people of Sarah Palin was enormous interest and excitement among Republicans. It really made that Republican convention come to life. So that's one kind of vice presidential pick. A second kind of vice presidential pick is somebody who's really going to help you in November in the election. And that would have been, say if Al Gore had chosen Bob Graham as his vice presidential nominee in 2000. You know, that would have been aimed at carrying Florida. And if he'd done that, maybe the last 8 years would have been pretty different. But then there's a third kind of vice president you can pick, and that's somebody that's good for you in January. That is when you're governing. And that is the pick that Barack Obama says he intended to make with Joe Biden, not somebody who was going to help him win the election. Because Delaware, you know, with all due respect, not very many electoral votes there. And not somebody that really took over the convention, because Barack Obama was quite capable of getting that Democratic convention very excited, but somebody who could help him govern. And I think that assuming that Joe Biden does not have gaffes or things that are that the administration has to deal with, he's going to be an extremely powerful advisor behind the scenes. If you want to look at the, you know, we talk about a team of rivals. I think the real team of rivals is Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden, because she's the Secretary of State, and he in many ways thinks he's the Secretary of State, because he's got that long history as chairman of the, as a leader in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And I think it'll be interesting to see if there are points of conflict there. But I think Joe Biden is in a period of transition, and that has made it necessary, whether he likes it or not, to keep a much lower profile.
There are many, many questions about the handling of the economy and the economic situation. And here's a question that struck me. Do you think that our era will turn out to be the end of the empire?
You know, I I'm doing a, working on a story now that won't run for another, for a couple weeks. So again, if you're blogging or Twittering, tweeting, please don't mention this. But it's about whether we're at a point where actually the kind of role of government is undergoing a shift. Because, you know, in past times when we've had these big economic crises, there have been regulatory and other institutions created that then persist forever. That's how we got the Federal Reserve. And that's how we got all the regulations, regulatory agencies put in place in the FDR era. So is this a similar point of transition? And among the people I interviewed for this story was Rahm Emanuel, the White House Chief of Staff. And he said he thought it was going to be one of those turning points in terms of the role of the federal government in the economy. And I said, well, what's your vision of where you end up? And he said, well, I don't think FDR knew, and neither do we. And I think that's probably right, that we're going to have a, we're not going to go back to the economic ground, the financial ground rules that we had before this crisis began. Things are going to be different. Exactly how they're going to be different, I don't know. In terms of the U.S. role in the world, I think the U.S. role in the world is changing. You know, we had that period after the Cold War where we were the big guy standing. But now we see that, you know, the rise of China and the reemergence of Russia in not entirely friendly ways, the European Union. So we're still the most powerful country in the world, but we're not the only contender for real influence in the world. That's a period of transition as well. And you see that reflected in the different tones that the two, our past two presidents have taken. Barack Obama on this trip talking a lot about multilateralism, international cooperation. George W. Bush, of course, after 9/11, his tone was more, you're with us or you're against us. A sharper line, a very different approach to the world than Barack Obama is taking.
There's quite a few questions about the news process, and I'm going to ignore most of them because they're pretty detailed. But here's a very interesting one. In providing real news coverage, how do you view the legitimate journalists vis-a-vis the TV personalities posing as journalists?
Well, there are some excellent journalists who are on television. I mean, Phil Jones was on television, and he was excellent, is an excellent journalist. And there are current journalists who are on television for whom I have enormous respect. Andrea Mitchell, I know pretty well. You know, nobody works harder than Andrea Mitchell and more aggressively as a reporter, so I have a lot of respect for her. There are these personalities on TV, and especially cable TV, that I just I would have less professional regard for. You know, they're entertaining and they're glib, but I'm not sure they know what they're talking about. And I worry about the constant, you know, whether there's a crisis or not. When you turn on cable TV news, you think there's a crisis. I mean, in fact, you can wake up, feel pretty good, think things are going fine, turn on cable TV, and suddenly you're very alarmed because there's just this constant churning of news events or creation of crises where there may not be crises and, you know, endless lather. So I worry about that, and I worry about the way it kind of infects our national conversation.
This question has kind of a double edge to it. I've never been polled. You talked about yep. USA Today's and Gallup's poll. How does the newspaper determine those polled?
We hire Gallup, and that's how we determine who gets polled. Gallup does this random dialing thing, which I can't explain. They for one of our polls, we call just over 1,000 people. That's our kind of standard sample. And they ask demographic data, so that when they get all the results from these 1,000 people, they balance it to make sure that it reflects the age groups of the American public and the income levels and the education levels. That's also a process that's very mysterious to me. And then they send us the results. So it's not fail-proof. I can tell you, as someone who wrote a story that ran the Monday before the New Hampshire primary about how Barack Obama had New Hampshire... I was ahead by 14 points, guaranteed to win, and then lost the next night. I can tell you that it's not infallible, but it is this long-tested way of doing sampling. That night of the New Hampshire primary, my husband, Carl Lubsdorf, is here. Until the end of the year, he was the bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News, and he still writes a column there. Phil was surprised to hear we were married, because we've only been married 27 years, so it somehow over Phil's head. But the night of the New Hampshire primary, we were in the same hotel room, and we had one hard line for the computer. And he was writing a column for the next morning's paper, but I was doing the news story. And so, you know, I'd gone out and talked to voters at a polling place in Nashua that afternoon, and weirdly could not find an Obama voter, which should have been a sign of something. And I came back, and, you know, I thought we were going to have not a very... If Barack Obama had a 14-point lead, that was not going to be a late night. But as when the first wave of exit polls came in, Barack Obama did not have a 14-point lead. It was about even, I think. It was too close to call. And when the second wave of exit polls came in, Hillary Clinton was ahead, which seemed very mysterious. And by the end, we were just frantically revising all the B matter, which is the material you write before something happens, you know, the boilerplate stuff, because we had been so wrong. We and every other pollster had been so wrong on how that election was going to come out. And we have, in USA Today, we have a news story on page one, which is kind of short, but we do a cover story every day that's kind of long. And because this was so interesting, at about 8:30 p.m., USA Today switched this story from being the news story, which is short, to a cover story, which is very long. So I am frantically writing, and Carl is screaming at me because he needs the computer line. But I can't give him the computer line because I've got to do this cover story on deadline. And it's lucky we'd been married for so long, because if we had been newlyweds, I'm sure this would have a very sad outcome. And he finally stomped out and went to a friend's, fortunately a friend of ours was also staying in this hotel, to use his computer line, where it was a very dramatic scene. But we got through that.
I'm going to ask a couple more, but before I do, I just realized I forgot to give you reasons to come back. There are a couple of books, and I'm going to leave them here.
Okay.
These are gifts of the club, Marco Island and Naples, and we wanted you to have these, and this will help you decide what you want to do with the rest of your weekend.
Well, it's such a beautiful community. It's really, you must just love it here. It was raining and cold in Washington when we left. I was pleased to hear it's raining again today there, because we're down here enjoying your weather and the beautiful water. So we're very, I was reluctant to come here when Alan called. Alan will tell you that he called me about doing this, and I said, I don't give speeches. And he said, no, you really like it. And he kept calling. He was very persistent. And I finally thought, this guy is never going away. So I said yes, and he's certainly right that we're very appreciative of the beautiful setting you have here.
This is to prove that not everyone in the audience has the same opinion. Your opinion of the unreasonable compensation for the captains of industry.
Ah. Well, what's your opinion? Are captains of industry, are these bonuses, not generally, but this whole bonus situation, how many people think that these bonuses are outrageous in this economic climate and they shouldn't happen? How many think this is how capitalism works and it's the way things should be? Well, that's interesting because I would have thought there would have been fewer people in that first group and more people in the second group. You know, I sort of feel like we're all in this together, this bad economy. And I see things like it. At USA Today, we have had not significant layoffs. In our Washington Bureau, we have about 30 people. In the Washington Bureau, we've lost one, who was our news assistant. But the paper has gone to furloughs. We each took a week's furlough in the first quarter rather than have layoffs. And I heard not a single complaint from a reporter or editor about taking an unpaid furlough for a week because it meant that the guy at the next desk was not going to get laid off. So I think it is encouraging when we see executives take that same attitude, which some executives have done. But those AIG bonuses after, in the wake of the huge amount of taxpayer dollars that had gone into AIG, I can certainly understand the response that a lot of Americans felt to that.
We've talked a lot, obviously, about the economic situation and about the new administration. And that begs the question that somebody was wise enough to ask. Who do you think will assume the leadership of the Republican Party during the next 4 years?
I am considering doing that because I have this Ann Coulter wig, which really ate me alive during this dinner. It came out in front of my face. I could not see a thing as I was singing. I think this is a big question for the Republican Party and not one that we can answer right now. Because who would you say right now is the spokesman for the Republican Party? I think you'd have to say Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh? How many people think Rush Limbaugh is this?
Not too many.
No?
Few.
How about Newt? Newt Gingrich? Newt Gingrich would like that, the people shouting his name. Bobby Jindal. Well, you know, Mitt Romney is clearly running for president again. He had a respectable run last time, although he didn't get to the nomination. If I were guessing who the nominee was in 4 years, I probably wouldn't guess because it's too far to know. But I think Romney could well be in that mix. It's hard for the when a party doesn't hold the White House, it is hard for them to speak with a united voice. And as the Republicans are certainly finding out. How about Mitch McConnell? Anybody think Mitch McConnell? Well, Mitch McConnell is the most powerful Republican in Washington now, and no one in this room thinks he speaks for the Republican Party. So that tells you a little bit about the disjointed state Republicans in. But, you know, this happens. Think about 1964. And while I'm very old, I didn't actually cover the 64 election, but 64 was this devastating election for Republicans and a time of real reexamination for the party. And look how strong the GOP came back after that. But I do think the Republican Party is now in a pickle. And if this president is successful, especially in dealing with the economy, Republicans will be in more of a pickle. I mean, while no one would wish bad news for our country, Republicans are better off if Obama is not an enormously successful president.
We've got so many questions. I'm gonna just summarize, I'm going to read four that all sort of hint at the same thing, and then we'll wrap it up. How can a person run the U.S. government with absolutely no executive or management experience? That's one. What is your estimate of how far the pendulum swings toward socialism during Obama's first term? Never wanting to waste a good crisis, will they go too far? How does Obama ever believe that our grandchildren will pay back the national debt? I guess this does the same thing. Does President Obama understand the debt our country is going to have and the consequences for generations?
I think questions about the deficit are smart because, we've got the Senate last night at about midnight went ahead and approved a $3.5 trillion budget for next year, which is a number. How fathomable is a $3.5 trillion budget? And we've got this $787 billion stimulus package, and we've got a $1 trillion bank bailout, and we've got money going to the auto industry as well. And there will come a day of accounting for all this spending. The White House, we picked this up in our polling, serious concerns about deficit spending. And we also hear the president talk about reducing the deficit, but at this point it's pretty much lip service because his priority is more in getting the economy going again. We had Newsweek run a cover a couple weeks ago that said we're all socialists now. I don't think that's true. I don't think it's that it's socialism, but it is a more bridled form of capitalism. And that is, I think, the direction that we're going with these a new regulation of non-bank financial institutions. And with the U.S., the federal government's role in reshaping these automobile companies, I think, is quite jaw-dropping. The idea that the government is replacing directors of the company and saying who has to step down as president of GM, and even directing the kind of products that they produce. Now, this administration thinks this is necessary, and they may be proven right, but it is definitely a different kind of capitalism than we've had here historically.
And one last question from a student. Do you have any advice for students on how to achieve their career goals?
Anybody in this room could probably give smart career advice because I know you've all had wonderful careers. I think you work hard. I think the number one thing you do is you find something you really love to do because then work is less like work. And I know that I feel so fortunate to have had a career in something I love to do. And then you work hard, and then you also try to keep your priorities straight, which include not only work, but also family and other things in your life. And that would be how I would measure the success of a life, and that'd be the advice that I would give.
And
also, I would say the last thing is never pass up an invitation to come to Naples, Florida.
Thank you very, very much, Susan Page.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Oh, good. Thank you. Thanks.